Blog Talk Radio.
And now a word from the Reverend Goodjob.
Fear! Our God is not a God of fear! No, our God is a God of love! The God to fear is Gilgamesh! He is a million feet tall, covered in an armor made of Gloranium! With his mighty thunder mace, he can kill us all in a single swat! Hail Gilgamesh!
That was a sermon from the Reverend Goodjob.
I tell you, the Reverend Goodjob sounds suspiciously like me. We're on the air tonight. Neil is not with us right now. He's a sleepy little boy, so he went to bed. And our friend, Mr. Posedown, he doesn't like us to use his name, Eric, he's up in the Northeast, and we're sending our thoughts to him, hoping he gets through this okay. Or at least hopefully the muted horde's killing quickly. Tonight we're going to be talking to Camden Toy. He's done a lot of different roles on television, most notably on Buffy the Vampire Slayer as one of the gentlemen, Gnarl, and the Uber Vamp, Datura Khan. How are you doing tonight?
Okay, I appreciate you asking me to come on the show. Thank you.
That's no problem. I was doing some research, and by research, I mean just going to Wikipedia. It says that you're... Yeah, sometimes you go to Wikipedia and, you know, IMDb, and I just hope that I'm not fed a pile.
Sure.
It said that your dad was a makeup artist or something like that. Is that true?
Yeah, my father actually had been an actor and a makeup artist, actually. And what happened was my mother got pregnant with me pretty early, actually, before they were even married. And it became very clear that he probably was not going to be able to make a living as an actor. But he was very, very good at makeup. He studied acting and makeup at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. And I guess several teachers of his recommended he maybe look into that. So somehow he got a connection to Wally Westmore, who was the head of makeup at Paramount Studios at the time. So it was actually the early to mid 1950s, he went out to L.A. to try his hand at that. Unfortunately, at the time, the Makeup Guild was unofficially closed. They weren't taking any new members. So even with Wally's help, there was nothing that they could do, unfortunately. So he went back to Pittsburgh, and I was born. And, I did see him do theater periodically growing up. And he also, he kind of gave to me that love of performance and also a love of makeup. Which was, an incredible gift.
Okay, when you're doing shows, have you ever helped design, costumes or makeup?
I wouldn't exactly say I've helped design, but I certainly give input into maybe... I was very lucky when I worked with Robert Hall's company, Almost Human, on Buffy and Angel. There were periodically... I would be able to talk to, for instance, the person who was sculpting... The actual design, and I would say, well, I'm probably going to be doing this with my mouth because of the accent or the way that this character is. I talk about expressions or how I would hold my mouth or whatever, and that was helpful sometimes. Like when I played the Prince of Lies on Angel, I knew I was going to be frowning a lot and very miserable, because he was very much a Nosferatu, and he took that into the makeup guy took that into account. And when he was sculpting it, he actually sculpted that sort of frown into the makeup, which made it so I didn't, they didn't have to re-glue my lips. Often about, two or three times during the day, usually they're having to re-glue the lips along the lip line because you're moving your mouth, you're talking, you're doing all sorts of stuff. And that eventually starts to wear. But because of the way they designed the makeup, it so perfectly matched what I was doing with the character, that they never even had to re-glue the lips, which was it's unheard of, actually.
Okay, when you're doing something, have you ever had to wear a costume or makeup where you're finding that it's making actually performing difficult, and you've had to go back and redesign it or something like that, or makeup people would?
Well, and for television, they don't really have time for much redesigning. I mean, one of the things that did happen, though, when we were playing, when Doug Jones and I were on the episode Hush on Buffy, Doug and I both, when we auditioned, we literally scared Joss with just our smiles with no makeup in broad daylight. And then the makeup design was such that they were going to originally have the smile sort of plastered on. In other words, sort of a prosthetic smile that was over our mouths. So we were going to have really no expression, really no use of expression for our mouth. And right at the last minute when the makeup design house, I think that was Optic Nerve, was doing it, they went to Joss to get him to sign off on the design. He said, well, no, wait a minute. We hired Camden and Doug because they literally scared the bejesus out of me with just their smiles, and now you're plastering over their smiles? No, he said, no, you have to redesign it. And they were like, well, we don't have time to redesign everybody's, but they did, the very last minute, redesign Doug's and my makeup, so we had full articulation of our mouths. What you see is, it is our mouth. They used these little veneers that went over our teeth, the little silver that went over our teeth.
Something I'm wondering about the episode, when they were showing the gentleman going around, they were floating.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
Some of the things they were doing it on the street, and I was wondering, how did they do that?
Well, anytime you saw our feet, which often you don't, but when you do see our feet, we are on wires. But if you look at the episode, I'm probably giving away too much, it's like magic, it's like a magic trick. Most of the time we're shot from the knee up or the waist up or even from the shoulder up. And in those cases, we are on little platforms that are on wheels that are on tracks, so that they're being pulled or pushed and guided by crew members. Yeah. And then what they do is they will, even within one scene, they'll intercut between that and maybe, us on wires. So it's very seamlessly, made to look like we're floating, even though in most cases we're actually on little platforms.
Okay, it was impressive because I remember every time I saw the episode, I wondered how it was done.
Yeah.
But it's like, I actually think one of the most traumatic things I ever saw was watching this behind-the-scenes video of Power Rangers, and it's like I saw the monster without his helmet on.
Yeah, I know. It's like it's a bit disconcerting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like no, it's all completely real. Which it's like with my kids or anything. If it's left up to me, they're never going to find out about Santa wrestling or anything. Yeah, I'm going to protect the lie for them, like I wish somebody had done for me.
Right.
Okay, when you were in the gentleman makeup, when you were playing the gentleman, was it difficult to see?
Not for the most part. I mean, there was a little bit of obstruction. All of the characters I played on Buffy and Angel, I'm wearing full sclera contacts, meaning that the contacts cover the entire white of the eye. Now, in the case of the gentleman, the pupil of those contacts was a little on the jagged, kind of ragged side to give it kind of an eerie, very odd kind of look. It's not something you would notice necessarily because it's pretty subtle, but it is kind of, it's as if they're kind of slightly blown out pupils. They're not like perfectly round, and because of that, that did obscure our vision a little bit, but not totally. And honestly, since we're on either platforms or wires, we didn't have to hit our marks. The crew guys that were operating those had to hit the marks for us. So it's a very unusual circumstance where an actor, I as the actor, don't have to hit a specific mark. Yeah. It was totally out of my hands. In fact, it was totally out of our hands, actually.
But was it hard to do that? Because I know sometimes, it's tough for me, sometimes just go upstairs or something, because I kind of get scared of heights. Was it difficult being kind of helpless in a way on the platforms or the wires?
No, it was, because, of course, they're not traveling at a very high speed for the most part. Although it was kind of, there was a funny circumstance that happened once when we were on, it was when we were floating outside going after Amber Benson, right before she runs into the dorms, that was on a slight hill. There was a little slight hill going down, and it's on a track. And what they're doing is they kind of control the roll down the hill by holding on to a rope and just sort of let it kind of roll down the hill, but like sort of controlled slow roll. But at the end of that roll, when they yelled cut, they didn't slow it down. They just sort of yanked it, stopped. You know, and which of course Doug and I aren't. We're not tied onto the platform, so we literally flew off the platform. It was the very first take on that scene. It was like, oh yeah, you need to slow that down instead of yanking it. And they were like, oh yeah, of course. So it was kind of a funny circumstance.
Okay, so how would it be? Because in that episode, it wasn't really necessarily heavy on fight scenes until near the end. It was more of those little assistants that you don't have. It seemed like they were kind of doing the legwork.
I'm sorry, what was the question? Say that again.
Was it difficult doing fight scenes as the gentleman, or were you just kind of being used like a prop?
Well, if you remember, we don't really have a fight scene. I mean...
Right, it's like we kind of
float to the background anytime somebody's fighting, and it's usually our footmen that are doing all the fighting.
Right.
That happens, we periodically, one of us will like float out and like stab somebody and then float back. You know, it's like we're very sort of stealth in that way. It's kind of funny.
Kind of like the illusion of movement.
Yeah.
Okay, when you got the episode, the gentlemen were, did you think it was going to end up being as big a deal as it was?
Well, we certainly knew it was special, but, you know, I don't think any of us fully knew how incredibly special it was going to be. I know Margaret Hamilton talked a little bit about that. You know, she was the one that played the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. She was like, wow, we had no clue what we were making. We certainly understood that this was very special, and it was written and directed by Joss, and it was unusual because it's a silent episode, and Joss is known for his sort of pithy, wonderful dialogue. So certainly we knew it was out of the ordinary. I don't think we fully knew that it was going to be as big of a deal. I mean, TV Guide is like rated as like one of its, you know, top. I think the Huffington Post too. Some of the scariest episodes on television.
Yeah.
So yeah, and if you anytime you talk to Buffy fans, almost across the board, they will name Once More with Feeling and Hush as their two favorite episodes. Almost across the board. It happens. I hear that all the time.
Yeah, it's really remarkable because it's such a popular episode, even though season 4 is far from a very popular season.
I know, isn't that funny? I know, it kind of stands out as this totally unusual episode right in the middle of season 4.
Okay, now later on you came on to the, you came back, was it season 7? You pulled double duty in season 7.
Yeah.
Or maybe 5 to 10 50, depending on how many of those models they used. You were playing Gnarl. Oh, yeah, I was going to mention one more thing about the gentleman because I wouldn't mention this on the air. When I was talking to you in Nashville, I mentioned the fact that the gentleman always reminded me of the two gophers from the old cartoons.
I know, and it's so funny you should mention that because Doug and I sort of thought of it that way. It's like, oh, no, after you. No, if you insist, no, you, okay, well, all right, thank you very much. It is a little like that. It's funny you should mention that because almost I don't think anybody else has seen that, and I've always sort of saw it that way too. Yeah, exactly.
I saw those cartoons so many times when I was a kid, and my co-host Neil always points out that their names are Macintosh. He's very belligerent to the point that I get their names right. But, you know, there's just something about that, two people being so polite as they're doing these incredibly sadistic things.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not like, it's not so much they're even taking joy in what they're doing, you know. It's just like, who did that? Just stand still. Let me cut you open.
Yes. We're incredibly polite, yes.
All right, when you played Gnarl in season 7, did you do anything else in any other episodes between those, as far as Buffy goes?
No, and in fact, it's funny. I didn't even end up auditioning for anything between season 4 and season 7. I was in touch with the casting directors during that time, and I occasionally would contact them about a role that I'd hear was up for something, and I go, gee, I think I might be right for that, and they would say, oh yeah, well maybe, and then they never called me in for whatever reason. It's kind of funny. I don't know why that is. I don't know. I think sometimes when you play such a strong, unusual character, it's hard for people to see you as other things. So it could have been that. I honestly don't know. But yeah, they called me in season 7. Actually, Lonnie Hammerman, who was one of the casting directors on the show, called me and was inquiring if I was available and if I would mind coming in and reading, which I said, of course, I'd be happy to. But they were having trouble casting that role, and they were thinking, you know, very Gollum-like, maybe small, almost maybe small woman even. They were thinking maybe 4'11", 4'7", 5', whatever, small. And whoever they were having in, just for whatever reason, they weren't really understanding the role. And it is a very fantastical, unusual role, very otherworldly. I mean, he's the Hannibal Lecter of the demon world. So that's not a typical kind of a role. I picked up the sides for it on a Friday. I didn't audition until Monday. So I had the entire weekend to play with the wonderful, wonderful script that Jane Espenson had written. And it just, I remember I was just so struck by how amazingly wonderful this role of Gnarl was. And no pun intended, there was a lot of meat to sink your teeth into with that role.
You know, one thing I noticed with it was I think anybody, you did such a good job because I honestly, Gnarl, as far as, you know, monsters on the show don't really scare me, but Gnarl is just creeps me the hell out.
It was, well, I think Gnarl was one of those wonderful, I think all the elements really truly came together with that. I mean, it was, first off, amazingly well written. And then as I was playing with it, all these kind of fun things kept revealing themselves to me. And then the makeup design was, and then the teeth, and then they gave me these like, long finger extensions with fingernails on the end of the extensions. And then I was like, oh, what would I do with these? Oh, I would probably clack them together. And as I was like taunting my victims, and there was all these little things came together so that when we finally stepped on the set with that, with the full makeup and the full characterization in place, even the producers, I think, were a little like, oh, my God, what have we given birth to here? Because in television, you know, everything is happening so quickly. I think a lot of times people don't have time to really develop unusual characterizations for things. And I think for whatever reason, that character just so fully came together. It was a force to reckon with, truly.
Okay, when he was... what were they using to simulate the skin he was eating?
It was just little strips of rubber that were actually, you know, cut out of the, you know, Allie's belly. It looked like I was, you know, what it was, they actually put a, there was like a, there was a prosthetic that they put on her belly, actually, a rubber prosthetic that then the little pieces were cut out of. They came like, they fit perfectly in there, so I was able to pull them out of that. And I wasn't really eating them. I was just putting them on my mouth.
Yeah. It looked like that Gnarl was very much enjoying what he was doing. not so much like the gentleman, but it was like somebody that really enjoyed their work.
Yeah, well, very much like, you know, like I said, he's really the Hannibal Lecter of the demon world. I mean, the beauty and wonderful kind of, and horror of Gnarl, actually, is the fact that he subdues his victims by paralyzing them, and then they are fully awake, but they can't move, while he slowly strips little pieces of skin off and just enjoys it. But he's also sort of enjoying the fact that they're awake and cognizant to what's happening to them, because they are dying, but it takes a long time to die, having your skin, you know, stripped off little piece by piece. So there's this incredible kind of... pleasure that goes along with that Gnarl has. I mean, that's certainly part of his whole, you know, psychology.
All right, well, you made a second appearance in season 7. You played the Uber Vamp, or the, is it Turek Han or Turek Khan?
Turek Hun.
Okay. I remember you pointed out to me in Nashville that you were the one that took 5 episodes to kill.
Yeah. Well, I think actually what happened was that I was killed in the 3rd episode, and then you see me very briefly in a 4th and a 5th episode is what happens after that. Yeah, like you see me in a vision that Buffy has, And then there's some other kind of dreamlike vision that somebody has in another episode. But yeah, but so I appear at the end of one episode, and then there's two episodes where there's quite a lot of fighting, and I finally get killed in the episode called Showtime.
Yeah, I said one thing we were talking about, and the way they we were talking about how they designed it to look like the Master in a way.
Well, they wanted to make sure that you got the feeling that the Master sprung from the Ubervamps. The whole thing was that the Master was one of the oldest vampires, but he had sprung from the Ubervamps. The Ubervamps were the original, you know, kind of vampires. They're to the vampires what the Neanderthals are to the humans. It's that kind of thing. They're these sort of ancient beings that in fact Giles in the episode, one of the episodes, says he'd only heard like rumors. He wasn't even sure they even existed up until he finally saw one. He was like, oh, I've heard about these, but I didn't even believe they existed. And they are truly the vampires that vampires fear. I mean, they're animals. They're not really human. In fact, it's funny, when we were putting together the choreography for it, I really very much, it was funny you should mention, you know, cartoon characters earlier, because I very much thought of him as like the Tasmanian devil. I thought of him as Taz, the way he kind of, and he kind of stopped. He's always spinning. You know, he's always in motion.
Yeah, because I was saying that was the Turcon, the Ubervamps, they were a lot different than the Gentlemen or Gnarls, because those were more sophisticated. They thought about what they did, while the Ubervamp was something that was just kind of a creature of instinct, like you said, like an animal. It's not thinking
he's
quite
a, he's
what
a,
it's
he's,
doing.
Yeah, I mean, he's truly, he's a killing machine. He really is. Yeah, and I had a stunt double in those episodes. Ryan Watson, who's this wonderful martial artist and stuntman. Check him out on the on IMDb. He's had an amazing career, and he was my stunt double during those episodes. But you know, I had to learn all the choreography. I mean, occasionally there'd be something I couldn't do, like one running along a wall or something, the way he would be able to do. But everything, or you know, falling off, you know, 50-foot drop off or something, those things I wasn't doing. But the actual choreography, I did have to learn. And Ryan and I really kind of learned to mirror each other's movements. So I think anybody would be really hard-pressed to be able to tell, you know, when it's Ryan and when it's me.
Yeah.
It's so perfectly put together. It really is.
All right. So you, when you worked on the show each time, I think the episodes you had each had a different director, didn't they?
Yes, and I'm trying to think if there's anybody I worked with more than once. I can't think of anybody, although certainly David Solomon did a lot of the directing of the second unit stuff, so I certainly worked with him quite a lot, and I know that James Cotner, who directed the Gnarl episode, the Same Time, Same Place episode, he was pulled in to do some reshoots on the Showtime episode. So I did get to work with some of those directors that way. But I don't think there's anybody that directed an entire episode that then I worked with him again on the second time on an entire episode. Not that I can remember.
Something I've always been interested about as far as TV directors go, because, you know, in movies, when a movie director's making something, they're trying to do a unique vision.
Sure.
You know, what they're doing. While TV, it's very important. It's like if you're doing a comic, so it's very important you stay on model. You're not there to express yourself necessarily. You're there to keep a coherent vision. And what I was wondering is, can you tell me, how were the directors different?
That's an interesting question. I certainly think, one of the similarities is they all have to move very quickly. I mean, we're shooting those episodes in 8 days. It's very, very fast. It sounds like a lot of time. Trust me, it's not.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and television, traditionally, you know, you work long, crazy hours. And I was working really long hours because I'm sitting in the makeup chair anywhere from 4 to 5 hours, and then at the end of the day, it's another hour to an hour and a half to take the makeup off, and then I have to have all the shooting time in between. So I was doing really long days. But the similarities and the differences of the directors, I'd say there's almost more similarities than there are differences in that they all really, they understand, I think, any director that's worth his or her salt, and that also, you know, continues to work. Because I think there are certainly television directors, some people just aren't cut out for television directing. You have to move very quickly. You can't be, you got to be fluid. You can't, you know, be, no, it's my vision. We have to get it because, well, you know, guess what, dude? We got to move on because the next setup is, we got to do the next setup because we have to hit X number of pages each day or you're going to fall way behind. So you can't be too beholden to your, you can't hold your vision as too precious, you know. I watched Joss even do that once, where one of our props wasn't working properly, and finally he just very calmly said, "Guys, we have to move on." And it was like, wow, you know, he was willing to let it go because we have to move on. We have a schedule, and in that case, the prop guys, you know, they got it working in another minute or two, so they were, "Oh, we got it ready." Okay, cool. So we did shoot it. But, yeah, I mean, everybody is, sometimes you have to be willing to just let go of things to be able to move forward. With that said, though, I have to say Jim Contner was one of the guys I remember who was one of the few directors I'd worked with who, when he called me to set, I didn't sit there for a half an hour or 2 hours before they actually used me. They actually used me immediately. Sometimes they're not always sure what the schedule is, which is understandable, and how quickly they're going to get to the next page and blah blah blah. So that sometimes, you know, they'll call to the, you know, second unit director to have, okay, get cammed in the lenses and the teeth and get them over here, and because they want to have me standing by in case, you know, they finish the shot and they just, you know, I understand that. But Jim he called me to set within 5 minutes. I was on the set actually working. It was pretty amazing. James came from a cinematography background. I think he was the focus puller on Spielberg's Jaws, actually, interestingly enough, when he was younger.
Okay. When you were filming those scenes as Norrell eating, you know, when Norrell was eating Willow's flesh, were y'all together at the same time, or were they filming reaction shots at separate times?
Yeah, actually, Allie and I were actually, we spent almost an entire, I used to always jokingly say I camped out on Allison Hannigan for a day, because I'm sitting, I mean, yeah, there were those scenes with Gnarl sitting on Willow. Yeah, I'm actually, you know, we're pretty much shooting them together. Yeah. She's there on the ground and I'm above her almost the entire time. Yeah. Pretty amazingly enough. Yeah.
How long did it take to film that and all, just the scenes of you and her together?
We shot those scenes, I think, in a day. I think we shot those in a day. And actually, it's funny. I mean, like I was saying earlier, we shoot everything in about 8 days, hour-long television, which actually it's actually 44-minute episodes because there's commercials. Those, we shoot those in 8 days. But when I shot Gnarl, they shot the Gnarl scenes in 3 days. We actually shot all my scenes in 3 days.
All right. So your final role on the Buffy Angel universe, you played the Prince of Light in a World War II episode.
Yeah, wonderful kind of flashback. It was such a kind of an ingenious thing that Steve DeKnight and Drew Goddard came up with. Yeah.
You know, my favorite bit from that episode is when Spike walks in and the guy in the submarine asked Angel, he said, "Is he a Nazi?" "No, he's not a Nazi. He just likes the fashion."
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, how did you look at playing the Prince of Lies as opposed to playing the Turret Khan or Gnarl or the Gentleman?
I'm sorry, say that again?
How did you take to playing the Prince of Lies compared to the other characters you played?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when I got the script, you know, they described him as this old, decrepit, this and that. I can't remember all the different adjectives. And then in parentheses it said, Nosferatu. So I thought, okay, I'm not going to, you know, reinvent the wheel here. He's an old, decrepit vampire, which is referred to as a Nosferatu. So I actually went back and watched every single film not, you know, Nosferatu appeared in. I went back and watched the original Nosferatu. I watched Herzog's remake Nosferatu. I watched Shadow of the Vampire with Willem Dafoe, and I really kind of my take on The Prince of Lies is very much kind of an homage to every actor that played Nosferatu. In a way, I mean, that's kind of how I approached it. I very much, you know, kind of looked at all those, you know, characterizations and kind of melded them together with a nice good dollop of my own kind of take on it as well.
One of the things I really appreciate about Buffy and Angel is they always had enough balls to kill off these great characters.
I know numerous fans have said. Yeah, numerous fans of mine have said, you know, why'd they kill you so quickly? And I'm like, I'm just a hired gun, baby. I didn't write this episode.
Yeah, because it takes a lot of balls to kill a character like the Gentleman, because you could have got an entire season out of those guys.
Yeah, well, Joss always used to say, you know, when he'd kill a really beloved character, and he'd get this huge, like, crazy response of, how could you do that? He always said, that he knew he had done the right thing when he gets that kind of response.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yo. So, you know, they have it's like this Prince of Lies, and he's a guy that's popped up once or twice in the comics.
Oh yes, I know. I was thrilled when I saw that when the Prince of Lies had popped up on the Angel comics. I was like, oh my god!
I love the story they used for how they called the Prince of Lies. And Spike, they admitted the fact that they were having a virgin blood party. And it was like three virgins and all these vampires.
God, was this, I can't remember, where was that? That was,
It was in Nazi Germany. It was in I think it was in the Spike versus Dracula miniseries.
Oh my god, yeah, I don't remember that at all. I think the original way that the name Prince of Lies came up, I think it was something that Drew Goddard had come up with in an earlier season for something. I can't remember what it was. And for whatever reason, that character wasn't used, or they decided they couldn't use the name. I can't remember what it was, but he had remembered he really liked the name. So he brought it up in that episode and said, can I use it here? And they were like, yeah, sure.
He had a very, what I really liked about him is he had a very old school classic villain vibe, a lot like the Master, which anybody, like a friend of mine, will tell you, it's like the Master's my favorite villain on Buffy. It's like, I'd rather watch a show of the Master and forget the rest.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just watch him killing humans and chilling. But, you know, the Prince of Lies, well, like, he had a very classic vampire feel. He wasn't trying to be, you know, hip or anything. It had a very classic evil to him.
Yeah, plus he was just really miserable and old and decrepit, and you know, he was, I always think of him as sort of a geriatric vampire, you know, but,
yeah.
and yet, very powerful still, even though he's old, he's certainly not frail, even though he looks frail, he's very powerful still, yeah.
He's kind of like that grandparent you dread seeing.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, actually. Yeah,
it's like you're obligated to kind of talk to them, and you're just trying to get through it as quick as they can.
Yeah, that's funny.
Them,
it's true.
Yeah, you'll ask them, how are you doing? And it's one of those things, and right after you ask them, how are you doing, you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just open the floodgates.
Yeah.
What projects have you done recently?
Well, last season I worked on, worked on two seasons of The Bay, which is an online soap opera. They're actually gearing up for their third season right now. And we were actually nominated for an Emmy Award this past season, which was really quite exciting. And I also worked on a sitcom that ran on cable on HDNet called Goodnight Burbank. And that was just a really fun series too, and very unusual in that, for me at least, because I rarely get cast in comedy, unfortunately, because I love to do it, but it's just not something that most producers and writers and directors think of me for, because I've done such creepy characters. But I was just thrilled when Hayden Black, the executive producer and writer for Goodnight Burbank, contacted me about it, and he said, he's thinking of this role for me, and I went, yeah, sure, it sounds fun. So we did some table reads of it, and I got cast in that, and that had a great cast. It was Laura Silverman from the Sarah Silverman Program, Miracle Laurie from Dollhouse. It had Dominic Monaghan from Lost and Lord of the Rings, just on and on. And then we had these amazing guest stars would show up on the show periodically, like, you know, Jim Rash from, you know, Community, and who was also, you know, won an Academy Award for, he was the, one of the screenwriters on The Descendants. John Barrowman from Torchwood was on a couple times for a guest star. Juliet Landau, who I'd worked with on Buffy. She had a guest starring role. So Claire Kramer had a small guest starring role. There were a lot of fun cast members to play with, and the entire cast were just so wonderfully cast. It was one of those wonderful kind of synergies between the actors and the actual roles themselves. So we had a great time. Unfortunately, it's not been picked up for a second season. We're still waiting to see if that will happen, but as of right now, it has not, I'm sorry to say. It's still available. You can still even though it's not running on cable anymore, it's still viewable on Hulu. You can still see it on Hulu, so check it out.
All right. Do you find it harder or easier to play to act without any makeup?
I don't really think of it as harder or easier. I approach it in a very similar way. Of course, the only difference I would say is that when you're in makeup, this is not always true, but when you're in particularly demon makeup or monster makeup, you're really from another realm. You're from this sort of fantastical kind of imaginary world, and it's almost often those characters. Here again, not always, but often, they're almost Shakespearean in their kind of girth and weight. There's something very unusual about them. They're not necessarily realistic or naturalistic characters. Although that's not always true. I mean, I don't know if you remember Skip, the big silver demon that was on Angel. He was played very, very, very straight and very kind of calm and very naturalistic, actually. He was like, hey, you know, I want to come over and watch the game and have some buffalo chicken wings. And he was a great character, although he was a huge and muscular guy with his, like, silver stuff and this and that. But he was played very, very kind of straightforward and naturalistic, which was a great choice. So you're playing really against type in that way. So that was one of those kind of unusual circumstances. But generally, when you're in that much makeup, it is an unusual, otherworldly role. So you can't just approach it the way you approach your everyday common, you know, roles, which I think is maybe one of the reasons why I get cast in those roles often, because I think they often have trouble casting those roles because I think actors come in and read for them and they don't fully get that this is an imaginary character from some weird... I think they do it like, you know, they would do it like they would do, you know, a normal naturalistic character. And sometimes that works, but sometimes it doesn't. And... I don't know. There's something I'm certainly very attracted to those kind of otherworldly characters.
I think sometimes it's one of those things that if you're under heavy makeup, it's like, I know I've heard this said sometimes, you know, like I'd watch wrestling in a stadium, you know, and these guys be wrestling, they'll be doing it more, you know, everything will be a lot more broad because there's people up in the cheap seats that have to be able to see what's going on.
Yeah, that's, I guess there's some truth to that, yeah.
So you kind of have to do your movements, you know, more exaggerated just to get across the basic movement. Would that be it?
Certainly there's some truth to that in theater, but I didn't find that with most of my prosthetic work on Buffy and Angel, and I think partly because those roles were all, you know, the makeups were very, very much like second skins, so they really moved with, you know, unlike, say, I know when Roddy McDowall did Planet of the Apes, those were some really, really thick prosthetics, so he had to really overdone. But I didn't find that to necessarily be true with the characters I did on Buffy and Angel, because they were really very much second skin. They became part of me, you know, and moved with my expressions.
Okay, when a scene would end, especially I was thinking something like when you're with Allison Hannon, like you said, you were basically paid to camp out on her for a day.
Yeah, I jokingly say
that.
When awkward
after scenes would cut, like, were y'all able to, you know, to just chat and stuff? I was just imagining, you know, it must be awkward, you know, to be sitting on top of somebody after pretending to eat their skin, you know, and it's like,
no, we did a lot of talking, actually. Yeah, we got to, it was Allie was great to work with. I adore her, and we had a great time. We really enjoy each other's company and working with each other. She used to jokingly say to me, "You're my favorite demon," which was really very, very sweet of her to say. But it was always, you know, like when I wouldn't see her for long periods of time and I'd run into her, like, you know, at an event or a party or something, it was always this kind of wonderful camaraderie that we had. So, no, we definitely got to know each other. And the same with, you know, when I was working with Sarah, like, we did a lot of the fight scenes as the Uber vamp. There were long night shoots where we would be sitting around, you know, between setups, because sometimes the setups take a while. And we had a lot of time to just sort of, you know, sit around and chat and get to know each other. And that was really a very special, wonderful time. I really enjoyed that, you know, that time.
Was it difficult to talk in the Uber vamp makeup?
Well, the Uber vamp, the teeth, they are full sets of teeth. And actually, that was one of those, you were asking about my input into makeup. That was one of the times where I remember saying to the guys over at Almost Human, "Guys, I'm going to be opening my mouth, these huge, like, big, huge growls. So it can't just be my front teeth. It has to go all the way to the back." And they were like, "Oh, okay." Like, because I know with Gnarl, it was not a full set of teeth. It was just the front, like, you know, like the front part, and it didn't go all the way back. But with Tara Khan, with the Uber vamp, those were full sets of teeth. So talking in those was a little more difficult, but they weren't set up for talking. I mean, the Uber vamp wasn't a verbal character.
Right, it was more growling and stuff, was it?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly could talk in them, but it was easier if I just popped them out to talk.
Yeah, you know, you were mentioning when David Denman was playing Skip, you know, and Skip actually had my favorite death on any of the shows.
Oh, that's right. That's right. But, you know, Angel were like really took him apart practically, yeah.
Well, Wesley was shooting him with a gun, and he looked as he said, "Really, does that ever work?" And I'm thinking, "Oh, dude, you shouldn't have said that." And it's like, he just dared God to throw some lightning, and that was right when a piece of his skin got ripped off and a bullet hit right in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, I always like when that happens, because I think it's the only way you can really die on one of these shows is if you start acknowledging the fact you can't die.
Yeah.
I was like one of those things, you know, I was in a wrestling, you know, whenever you hear the announcers talking about what a great champion somebody's been, it's like, that dude's losing.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, and it's the same thing I think on any TV show, you know, when you hear somebody openly taunting, you know, saying, "Oh, what are you going to do, shoot me?"
Yeah. I'm sorry, say that again?
It's like if you're daring somebody to shoot you or you're acknowledging the fact that you can't die, it's like, oh, boy. And, like, it goes back to Amazing Spider-Man 3 when Spider-Man was talking about how nobody can stop him and then Dr. Octopus beat the crap out of him.
Yeah.
All right, thank you for talking to us. We're about to run out of time because they cut us off at 45 minutes.
Gotcha. No problem. Yeah, thank you very much for asking me on the show. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Is there anything you want to plug that's coming up?
Yeah, just real quick. I'm going to be shooting a film in Texas coming up next week called Now Hiring. It's a really fun film. It's a romantic comedy superhero movie, and I'm playing the supervillain, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And then I have a film I'm working on with Joe Hollow called A Blood Story, which is going to be really fun. We'll be shooting later in the season. And then early next year I'll be working with Tony Todd and Doug Jones and Claire Kramer on a film called Monster School, and that should be a lot of fun too. That's written and produced by Len McLeod, who had won a Saturn Award for producing the remake of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which, if your listeners have not seen it, I highly recommend picking up a DVD copy of it. It's quite wonderful.
All right. Tell you what, whenever the stuff's ready to come out, can you shoot me a link, and I'll make sure to promote it for you with what little
influence
I have.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
All right, man. You have a good night.
Thanks. You too. Take care.
All right. Everybody, Horsepower and Cosmic Forces should be returning next week. Good night.